From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. And let's get the latest on that powerful earthquake that struck the mountainous central region of Italy overnight. Italy's Civil Protection Agency says at least 73 people have died. Philip Pulilla is senior correspondent for Reuters. He joins us from Rome, about 60 miles from the epicenter of the earthquake. And Philip, what can you tell us about the area hit by the quake?
Well, the area is about 100 or so kilometers northeast of Rome. The earthquake hit on the border between three Italian regions, Lazio, Umbria, and Marche. This is an area of mountains and hills, and there are many people who have sort of summer homes there. So it was basically at peak population. The difficulty is these are, as I said, mountain and hill towns. So just a little bit of rubble can interrupt a road, not to mention a collapsed house. So rescue efforts are difficult because of that.
And it is somewhat of an earthquake-prone region. I mean, I'm remembering the earthquake that hit Assisi a while ago in Umbria. So they have had troubles there before. But we've heard that this time around there are some small towns, or at least one, where the mayor has said that the town is basically gone, that it's collapsed entirely?
That's mostly true. If you look at the air pictures, obviously these are emotional things that are said, but most of the town is no longer there in the sense that much of it is flattened. If you look at it from aerial photographs, there's basically it's like 80% rubble. Even the survivors no longer can stay there, so they are now homeless. The images are very, very grim. It is a miracle, in my opinion anyway, that the death toll is not higher.
Well, and the town that we were talking about, I believe, is the town of Amatrice. Is that
that's correct?
That's right.
That's correct, yes.
Do we know if people are still trapped in the rubble?
There certainly are, because I've covered many earthquakes here in Italy. I've been here for nearly 35 years, and it takes time for rescue workers to get to these places. They got there rather quickly. Of course, the first rescue efforts were done by the residents themselves, who were digging through rubble with their bare hands. But there are still people under the rubble. There are sniffer dogs that are helping rescue workers to locate people. Every half hour or so, see that someone has been rescued, and thankfully they are still alive. In one of the other towns nearby, Amatrice, there was an entire family was wiped out, and it was quite tragic to see the footage on TV. It was basically a father, mother, and a 9-year-old boy, and an 8-month-year-old boy, and the grandmother was wailing as the body of the 8-month-old boy was taken out, and she cried in Italian, "He took them all at once." He, obviously, being a reference to God.
Hmm. Well, as you mentioned, this is a mountainous and remote region. It will take the full complement of Italy's rescue crews some time to get there. Do we know if Italy will ask for or need help from the international community?
The European Union and neighboring countries have offered help. Italy has said so far that it is not needed. Italy is rather advanced in responding to earthquakes because they've had a lot of experiences as one of the most seismic countries on Earth. There are two major fault lines going through the country. The first earthquake that I covered here was in 1980 in the south. There were 3,000 dead. That was a disaster as far as coordination was concerned. Since then, the Civil Protection Department was established, and they are very, very good. They get to places as quickly as humanly possible. They are very well organized. They've got volunteers all over the place, locally, nationally. They've been trained to stream in and get there as quickly as possible. So they are doing a good job.
And Philip, you are speaking to us from Rome. There were reports that the quakes were felt as far as Rome. Did you feel it?
Absolutely. It was felt not only as far as south as Rome, but it was actually felt as far south as Naples, which is about 2 hours even further south than Rome, and it was felt as far north as Bologna, which is very interesting because the earthquake was very shallow. The epicenter was only 4 kilometers deep below the surface of the earth, which is a very shallow earthquake. It could have caused much, much more damage if it had been in a heavily populated area.
Well, Philip Pulilla is senior correspondent for Reuters, speaking to us from Rome. Philip, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Well, here in this country, on the campaign trail, Donald Trump is talking immigration again. But last night on Fox News, Trump made it sound as though he's no longer calling for every undocumented person in the country to be deported.
There certainly can be a softening because we're not looking to hurt people. We want people. We have some great people in this country. We have some great, great people in this country. So, but we're going to follow the laws of this country.
Republican Alfonso Aguilar is president of the Latino Partnership for Conservative Principles. He was director of the Office of Citizenship under President George W. Bush. And Alfonso Aguilar, what do you make of this softening of the immigration position by Donald Trump? And how much of a softening is it?
Well, I mean, to be fair, from the very beginning, he talked about people leaving the country and the good people returning to the country right away, quickly. So I imagine that he's looking to a way to do that in a compassionate and humane way. Just this Saturday, he met with a group of Hispanic advisors, and that's exactly what he said. And again, I think this is something that he said from the very beginning.
But he'd also talked about a deportation force. And now it sounds like they're kind of backing off of that idea.
Well, you know, he was asked about a deportation force, but let's be fair. A deportation force already exists in our country. It's called Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And their priority is to go after criminals. And that's what Mr. Trump is saying. Look, I'm not going to defend Mr. Trump's comments. During the primary, he said some very offensive things that really antagonized Latinos. But having said that, I think he's looking to be more constructive on the issue, more positive. Certainly, there's a political angle. There's certain battleground states like Florida, Colorado, Nevada, North Carolina, where he needs to do better with Latino voters. And this may actually help. But I think this is encouraging. I don't see it as a major flip-flop.
So if there is somebody out there listening to this who is an undocumented immigrant, would the idea be that that person, as you understand Trump's position, that person would have to go back to their home country and then come back in and apply legally? So they would have to leave under Trump's plan?
Well, that's what he said originally. However, logistically, that would be very difficult to do. You know, I've been talking to one of the Trump advisors, and I suggested, what if that touchback, you know, that's called touchback when they go back to their country and then reenter, what if that were to happen inside the country, an internal touchback, if you will, where an individual would go to his embassy or consulate, touch back there, get a certificate saying that they're here illegally, and start their path to legal status. I think one of the participants in the meeting that Mr. Trump had on Saturday did say that Mr. Trump asked about that possibility of people registering in embassies or consulates. So I think that the idea of internal touchback is being considered. But let me tell you, that's something that would be received very well by the Latino community. Their number one concern is bringing people out of the shadows. It's not citizenship. It's actually bringing people out of the shadows. And ironically, this proposal, if he were president, I think would actually help create the consensus that we need in Congress between Democrats and Republicans to get something done.
But before we get to that point, how is it going to be received by the people who are chanting "Build that wall" at every one of his rallies? People who really like the fact that he's been taking a very hard line on immigration.
Well, again, he's been very consistent. I think the same people know what he said from the very beginning, that he wanted the good people to come back. I think they're more concerned about those people who have criminal records. And Mr. Trump has been very clear that those people will be removed. Latinos understand every single immigration reform package that has been debated in Congress has included fencing. Hillary Clinton voted for fencing, not for one fence, but for two walls.
But not across the entire border. But
Mr. Trump is not proposing that either. What Mr. Trump has said is that it wouldn't be 2,000 miles. He's only saying where there is illegal entry. And there are areas of the border, like the El Paso sector, that is really out of control. And for Hillary Clinton not to accept that, and I think it's hypocritical for her not to talk about building bridges when she actually voted continuously, supported fencing and double-layer fencing, not one wall, two walls. So it's ironic. A lot of the things are going to come back, I think, to haunt her.
Several months ago, you had refused to endorse Trump. What brought you around to endorsing him?
Well, as I've said, I mean, his comments were offensive. I'm not going to defend them. But I realized that in this election, too much is at stake. And as much as I dislike some of the comments that Mr. Trump made, I am more concerned about Hillary Clinton's dangerous policies regarding the economy, appointments to federal courts, particularly the Supreme Court. And on immigration, I just don't believe her. I mean, I think like Obama, she's using this issue politically when she says it's a path to citizenship or nothing and that she will go beyond Obama on executive action. She's basically telegraphing a message to congressional Republicans, I'm not going to work with you. Ironically, and this is the very irony of politics, we may have a better chance of getting some form of immigration reform that brings people out of the shadows with Donald Trump, despite all his offensive comments. But that's a reality, perhaps the weirdness and the surreality of politics.
That's Alfonso Aguilar, who is president of the Latino Partnership for Conservative Principles. He served in the George W. Bush administration. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And by the way, news today that joining Trump at a rally in Jackson, Mississippi tonight will be Nigel Farage, one of the leaders of the Brexit movement. This week, the film The Man Who Knew Infinity is out on DVD and on demand. It's about mathematician Srinivasa Ramanujan, who in the early 20th century went from India to Cambridge, England to work with mathematician G.H. Hardy. The film stars Dev Patel, best known for Slumdog Millionaire, as Ramanujan, and Oscar winner Jeremy Irons as Hardy.
Let me ask you something. Why do you do it, any of this?
Because I have to. I see it.
Like Euler. Form for its own sake, an art unto itself. And like all art, it reflects truth. It's the only truth I know. It's my church. And you, just as Mozart could hear an entire symphony in his head, you dance with numbers to infinity.
We spoke with Jeremy Irons and Dev Patel when The Man Who Knew Infinity opened in theaters. I began by asking Irons what he'd known about Ramanujan before making the film.
I knew absolutely nothing about Ramanujan. I mean, anything about mathematics, I ran away with from as soon as I left school. I wasn't very good at mathematics, and my father was an accountant, as was Dev Patel's father.
There you go.
This is one thing we share.
Serendipity.
So,
when did you leave school, by the way?
In about 1840. I thought nothing about mathematics at all. And when this story came along, I thought it was an extraordinary story. And I mean, you know, I thought I know nothing about this man. And I don't think many other people know much about it. Not that I play the great mathematician, Dev, who's about to tell you about him. He plays Ramanujan.
Did you know who he was?
I wasn't aware that I knew about him. I read the script and there was that sort of light bulb moment. And I realized that, you know, that scene in Good Will Hunting where Robin Williams is talking about this amazing mathematician that kind of was plucked from obscurity in India at the bar. And I was like, wait a minute.
Oh, is that the one?
Yeah, so he was the gentleman they were talking about.
Well, what drew you to this?
I mean, it's a no-brainer for someone like me to play a part like this, you know, to have such an incredible role. The fact that he's a real human being that existed and conquered, you know, the field of mathematics with the help of Jeremy's character, G.H. Hardy, it was truly a blessing and an honor for me, really.
And G.H. Hardy, by the way, the real G.H. Hardy, has said of his relationship with Ramanujan that it was the one romantic incident in my life.
Yeah, I think he was talking about romance in a slightly different way than we normally have it. I think it was the colorful time of his life. You know, he was an academic, pretty dry. And here he met this young Indian man who would dream his mathematics, literally wake up with the knowledge in his head and write it down. Hardy was an atheist, a bit of a geek, probably hopeless at personal relationships. And when he invited this young Indian to come to Cambridge in 1913, I think it was the colour and the excitement that this young man brought to the very stuffy Cambridge academia that he was trying to describe.
And he was a character who was married to his work, so
absolutely
he found romance.
Yeah, couldn't even look at people in the eye. A brilliant mathematician, not as brilliant as Ramanujan. But I don't think we should keep saying mathematician too often, because really this isn't a film about that. I mean, that's the wallpaper of the story. That's what surrounds it. But it's about the developing relationship between these two very disparate people who were fascinated and by pure mathematics.
That's really the base. You know, their art form, which was mathematics, brought them together.
But it could have been mountaineering,
yeah,
or indeed double bass playing.
Yeah, or space travel, anything really, yeah. You know. But it's about these men who have different processes about how they get to their work. One is an atheist, and one man believes that everything is a gift from his God. And in the world of mathematics, where you require proofs and evidence, you know, that doesn't really go down well. So not only did he face a lot of prejudice because of the way he looked, the way he dressed, but also his process, you know.
Because in those days, I mean, India was, you know, a sort of a part of the subcontinent, and we'd colonized India, and, you know, the Indians were certainly not people who should come to Cambridge University. So it was...
And he wasn't even respected in India, you know?
Yeah.
So that's the beauty of it. It's kind of so ahead of its game in a way, in certain, even though it's a period piece. What you're dealing with and that relationship, what Hardy saw in him, he was truly a groundbreaker as well in his vision.
You have done a few films now that involve the Indian... British colonial,
yeah. I wonder
relationship.
Why.
Are people just seeing them and then they say, oh, I know the perfect guy for this film?
I don't know. I've got a bloody good manager.
But this, at the same time, I mean, this is what you would expect from an actor of your caliber, but it's a very different role than the role in,
yeah,
Best Exotic Marigold Hotel or Slumdog.
Yeah, that was
Slumdog.
One of the reasons. I think Slumdog was a very long time ago, and... you know, I was thrust into a certain limelight, which I think I can honestly say was slightly premature.
You were, you know, only how old?
I was 17.
Yeah.
And it was my first film. I still don't fully understand the craft of acting, but I certainly didn't back then. And there was part of me, truthfully, that kind of felt a bit unworthy. And, you know, it's been, you know, difficult picking and choosing parts and, you know, getting in certain rooms, but it's been a slow process, like with every actor, regardless of your skin color. And, you know, I went out and did this film called Marigold, and it was a comedy. And I felt that everyone kind of looked at me as, oh, that funny guy in that film. This was an opportunity for me to play someone a lot more grounded and share the space with this fella over here.
Well, and by the way, everybody that I've spoken to as I've been preparing for this has said they all know you, Jeremy Irons, from something different. Mm-hmm. I'm 33 years old. I got my first dose of Jeremy Irons when I watched you as Scar in The Lion King when I was growing up.
When you listened to me as Scar.
When I listened to you as Scar.
Yeah. You're a young man.
Well, you know what's weird, though, is I was really ill in school and I had a day off. I was really young. My mum got me a tape, and it was a movie I really wanted to watch, you know, VHS, and it was Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, my God.
Were you in that, Jeremy? You were?
I'm afraid I was.
I love that film. I had it. I remember watching that every time I was sick for a long time.
Well, what was it? What was it like to do this film with all of the roles that you've played over the years? What did you like about this character?
I liked the setup of the movie. I mean, Ed Pressman was... producer, and he'd produced Reversal of Fortune, which I made a few years ago. To work with Dev, who I admired hugely, and who's so different from me. It's very nice when two actors who are very different, just not through age, but nationality and everything. It's great to work with an actor like that. And he's very, I mean, Dev, you say you're inexperienced, but you have a great instinct, you know. You're open, you have no you're just... You know, you're very clear as an actor, and that's lovely to work with somebody like
that. What have you learned from him? And I'm
going
to ask you the same question. Well,
that.
I will ask you that question, but is there anything that...
No, I just... I see things in Dev that I know, and it just confirms to me that I'm right to value that quality in an actor because it works. He's like me in that he doesn't plan too much. He just sees what comes and does it and feels the moment and lives in and acts in the moment, which is very good for film.
What have you learned from him?
We did this scene where I basically sit down for most of it. It was half a day watching Jeremy in his room explain to my character the importance of playing the way that, you know, Cambridge wants me to play. And he speaks about all these great mathematicians like Jacobi and Euler. And there was that moment where he comes in with this kind of grace and ease. And I remember him just walking up to the blackboard and deciding to write the names down and clean them off and do all these things that were so freeing. And I went home that day and I was like, it is such a privilege for me, you know? And it's difficult to say that when you're in the roles and you're playing these characters. It's like kind of telling your dad you love him or something. It's difficult. Well, for me anyway. But like in this space now, I'm very lucky, you know. It was a beautiful experience watching each take unfold ever so slightly differently. Hmm. And, you know, I felt like someone in a dark theatre watching Jeremy Irons for a lot of the day. It was really cool.
Enough already. And moving swiftly on.
And back to Dungeons & Dragons, so basically.
Well, Jeremy Irons, I want to ask you a question because as we've been listening to your voice, which I love, and I think you should just have your own NPR show that's just you talking for an hour. But the one of the – they call it an EGOT when you win an Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar, and a Tony. You're missing – A Grammy.
I know. I'm working on my singing.
You could win one for MTV for Movie just Award, speaking, right?
Yeah. Bollywood Star Award.
Speaking?
You can win a Grammy just for – I think – didn't Hillary Clinton just win one or something
like that?
So if – I mean, but you could also sing.
No, but it'd be easy because, I mean, Adele is hard to beat.
I think we need to get him gunged.
It'd be nice to have an EGOT.
Right now you have a toe. You have a Tony, an Oscar, and an Emmy. But you're missing the G. So,
what's that? A Golden
or an
Globe?
EOT.
Yeah.
Oh, you want to count Golden Globe?
Well,
there you go.
That's an EGOT.
An eggnog.
An eggnog. Well, Jeremy Irons and Dev Patel, the film is called The Man Who Knew Infinity. Thank you both for joining us.
Bless you. Come and see the film.
And our interview with Jeremy Irons and Dev Patel originally aired in April. You can now see The Man Who Knew Infinity at home. It is available on DVD and on demand this week.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron, helping make delicious home-cooked meals by sourcing from artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, you choose from a range of recipes that can be made in 40 minutes or less. Pre-measured ingredients delivered to your door only when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here.
There's increasing excitement among cancer researchers regarding the potential of immunotherapy. Those are treatments that use a patient's own immune system to fight cancer. One promising experimental therapy, particularly for blood cancers, is called CAR T-cell therapy. It's extreme and very risky, but when it works, it can make cancers disappear entirely. Meghna Keshavan is a biotech correspondent for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. She joins us. So how does this therapy work?
So we have these white blood cells in our bodies called T cells. They're considered kind of the serial killers of our body. They kill infections. They'll go after cancer cells. So basically, the doctors will remove your own blood cells from your body, re-engineer them, and then feed them back into your body.
So an exciting potential there. But you also write that it has to nearly kill you if it's going to save you. Why is that?
So the way that you know that this therapy is working is that your immune system kind of goes haywire. It just gets a little out of control. And when that happens, you get severe fevers, trouble breathing, all kinds of things. But it is indicating that these T cells are active and they're actively attacking the cancer and just releasing all of these chemicals that are causing an immune response. But it's a very, very strong immune response that could nearly kill you if not managed properly by doctors.
Hmm. Have people died?
Oh, yes, yes. 4 patients have died from side effects in the past year. That said, they also have a very high cure rate of, you know, these blood cancers. I want to be specific, by the way. CAR-T is working in blood cancers, and they haven't really figured out how to do this in solid cancers like breast or ovarian.
Right. So what is the cure rate then? What is that very high cure rate?
So I spoke with somebody from the National Cancer Institute, and she's saying that with lymphomas and leukemias, half are getting cured. And in children who have these blood cancers, it can be like 85% even.
So potentially really high. Okay.
Really, yeah.
Well, so for those people whom this experimental therapy has been a success, do they have any long-term complications or side effects that we yet know of?
I did speak to a patient who has been cancer-free for a year and a half after being told she was terminal a couple years ago with a type of cancer. And her immunity has gone down a little bit. She has to take shots of something called immunoglobulin to, like, boost up her immune system. But other than that, she's okay. She is a little more susceptible to getting sick. But besides that, her energy levels are up and she's, you know, living life.
I'm going to guess that she thinks that's a small price to pay to be free of her cancer.
Absolutely.
Well, how close is this therapy to gaining approval and moving out of these experimental or clinical trial phases?
So they're in pretty late stage trials right now. And if all goes to plan, two companies could have this CAR-T product in patients next year.
So if CAR T-cell therapy is ultimately approved for use beyond these experimental phases, at what point in time might doctors prescribe it? I mean, is it a first-line type of therapy? Or, I mean, the people that you talked to, it was sort of their last resort.
Yeah, I think the doctors are still trying to figure that out. Right now, the trials are being done in people as a last, you know, resort. However, the patient that I spoke to, she was relatively healthy compared to a lot of the other patients, and it cured her effectively. And she thinks that it could be a first-line therapy. A lot of the researchers also think that. But right now, since we're so early in the research process, they're not necessarily saying that this is the first way, like the first approach.
Hmm. Well, Meghna Keshavan is a biotech correspondent with our partners at STAT. And can we just acknowledge that we have a Meghna and a Meghna doing this conversation? There's like a wormhole or a tear in the space-time continuum that has brought us together.
It makes me happy.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
After a pre-dawn barrage of airstrikes and heavy artillery, Turkey sent tanks and special forces into Syria today. They're trying to clear ISIS out of the border town of Jarablus. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said he launched the offensive in response to last weekend's attack on a Kurdish wedding party in Turkey. That attack killed more than 50 people. Meanwhile, Vice President Joe Biden is visiting Turkey today. He's trying to ease some of the recent strain between the two countries. There has been some concern in Turkey that the U.S. didn't send a strong message of support for the government in Ankara after the failed coup attempt last month. Mike Giglio is a Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News, and he joins us via Skype from Istanbul. And Mike, welcome to Here and Now.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So first of all, what is the significance of today's military action by Turkey?
It's a major escalation for Turkey in Syria. This is the first time they've launched a major operation across the border. You know, it's against ISIS, but it has involved them sending special forces and tanks in support of Syrian rebels, and it's really just drawing them into the conflict in a way that they haven't been before.
Do we know if the U.S. military is involved in Turkey's moves today, and if so, how?
I spoke to a Turkish official this morning who said that U.S. was on board, his words, with the operation, and what we've seen is U.S. officials have since said in the press that the U.S. is supporting it with drone surveillance, that U.S. advisors are advising the Turks on the Turkish side of the border, and that if needed, they will also send fighter jets to protect the Syrian forces involved in this. So, both sides are painting it as a coordinated thing, which is important because one of the targets of Turkey's actions today is to send a message to the U.S.-backed Kurdish forces inside Syria not to move on this territory. And there's going to be some tension worth monitoring there.
Is there any coincidence that Vice President Biden is there today? Was it timed around that visit?
It's suspicious timing. This visit, has been in the works, and they need to address a lot of different concerns. You know, relations between the U.S. and Turkey have not been very good since the attempted coup here, which Turkey blames on a cleric living in Pennsylvania. But, the operation has been in the planning stages for at least a few days. We've seen forces massing down on the border there in Turkey. But interestingly, when I spoke to that Turkish official today, he told me that one of the things that had spurred the timing of this is that the Kurdish militia in Syria, the YPG, had advanced toward the town in question of Jarablus yesterday. And I think if that's the case, and that's a very bad sign for the way this was coordinated. And for the timing of everything.
Hmm. Well, let's zoom out here for a second and tell us how today's action by Turkey fits into the overall fight, the overall efforts against ISIS right now.
You know, in Syria, the U.S. is trying to manage a lot of competing interests. And I think the best example of that is the fact that the most important U.S. ally in Syria is the YPG, which is an ethnic Kurdish militia that is the sister organization of the PKK, which is an insurgent group here in Turkey that is fighting a war with the Turkish government. because of this U.S. support, Turkey has been very wary of the YPG, this Kurdish group in Syria, and there's been significant disagreements with the U.S. over the fact that they are supporting them and tensions because of it. And what the U.S. has to really be careful about is seeing this kind of suspicion between Turkey and the YPG blowing up and turning into something more serious. Because on the other hand, Turkey is also a very key U.S. ally in the war on ISIS, and especially in Syria. So they really need both of those actors to get along. And I think this is going to be very delicate balancing act here with this offensive into Syria.
Yeah. Well, Mike, we wanted to talk to you about specifically how the U.S. military is being used or is involved in the fight against ISIS, because you've been on the front lines with U.S. troops and Kurdish forces in northern Iraq. We'll link our listeners to your story at hereandnow.org. But tell us, first of all, what did you see there?
Yeah, so in Iraq, U.S. forces have been very involved in the ISIS fight on the ground, in and close to combat. And I think to a much larger extent than most Americans, including myself, before I went to Iraq recently and reported the story, might think. In northern Iraq, where I was, they're working primarily with a different group of Kurdish fighters. This is the Kurdish Peshmerga. And the U.S. has a long relationship of working alongside them, dating back to the Iraq War. So I went and visited some of the front lines where the Peshmerga are dug in across from ISIS. And I found that U.S. Special Operations Forces and Special Forces are pretty regular presence there. And I interviewed some of the Kurdish commandos who have fought alongside U.S. Special Operations Forces in some pretty dangerous operations against ISIS. And they also said that, you know, these U.S. commandos are a key part of the fight, and, you know, they're risking their lives pretty regularly. And, you know, the third part of that, of the reporting there, was to actually go out to some of the U.S. bases, or one of the U.S. bases, excuse me, in northern Iraq, which is helping to coordinate the eventual offensive for Mosul, and just speak with the U.S. officers and soldiers there about what they're seeing. And the message I got from them is that they're pretty well aware of the fact that they are in a combat environment, as they put it, 24-7. And this is a very dangerous mission that they're on.
Well, I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but the Pentagon says that 16 U.S. service members have been wounded, and we know that 3 Americans have been killed in recent combat in Iraq. An American was also killed in Afghanistan yesterday. You know, that just sort of reiterates what you were saying, that they're clearly in harm's way and in, you know, in combat, essentially. But how does that square with how the Obama administration has been portraying what U.S. combat troops are doing?
Right. I mean, this is a very sensitive topic for the Obama administration, because he came to office promising to get us out of wars, and specifically out of the Iraq War. And I think the fact that, you know, we're involved in a new one now is politically difficult for him. They have admitted when soldiers have died. They have said that people, that U.S. service members will be in dangerous situations. But I think what there's been a concerted effort from the White House to do has been to de-emphasize that, to kind of shift the narrative away from the fact that U.S. soldiers and servicemen are out there on the ground regularly, and to keep it more focused on the fact that the U.S. is conducting airstrikes, that they're basically, the war is relied on air power and advising local forces. It has, and that's a key component of the war. I just think there hasn't been enough focus on the fact that they're also, as you mentioned, on the ground, shedding blood, risking their lives, and that's happening as a key component to the war.
And there's so much going on in Iraq. I mean, there's supposed to be a new offensive to try to retake Mosul from ISIS. I mean, will U.S. troops be involved in that?
I think that they'll be involved to the same extent that they are right now. And what that means is, you basically have the base that I visited outside a city called Makmur. The U.S. soldiers stationed there, their role is to advise and assist the Iraqi and Kurdish forces as they do this offensive. Now, that means sitting back in a command room and going over the battle plans and coordinating a lot of this. It also means that they've been providing artillery support. And so while I was driving around this area, you know, I saw a U.S. artillery convoy out in the field doing fire support for Iraqi military advances. I've also heard from local soldiers that U.S. troops will come out to the front lines to call on airstrikes. They will fire mortars at ISIS, which means that they're then in mortar range of ISIS as well, that they're conducting surveillance, often flying drones. All these things put them in harm's way. And I think that as the fight gets closer to Mosul, it's going to get deadlier. And just by the nature of the way this is going to play out, you're going to see a lot of the same kind of actions from the U.S. troops, and it's going to be in a really dangerous environment.
Yeah. Well, Mike, I wonder. I mean, we hear all the time, or we're told all the time, that ISIS is losing territory in Iraq and Syria. Based on what you saw and your reporting, is that true?
Yeah. So the Pentagon says they've lost 45% of their territory over the last 2 years. I think a lot of that might be unpopulated areas, so it's perhaps overstating it. But I have visited Iraq in particular throughout the last 2 years and gone to the fronts. And on this trip, I can say there really is a sense among the Peshmerga forces and also among the U.S. troops that I spoke to of momentum, that for the military piece of the battle against ISIS, as far as taking territory for them, that they really are picking up steam. And I think we can expect an offensive on Mosul, which has been promised for a long time, to actually kick off towards the end of this year. And I do think eventually the feeling is that ISIS will lose Mosul, which would be a really major loss for them.
Well, Mike Giglio is Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News. He's speaking to us from Istanbul via Skype. Mike, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
California's mandatory water conservation program ended back in June, and there's already proof that Californians are backsliding in their efforts to save water, even though the state's drought is in its fifth year. According to recent water use numbers, the state's urban residents saved water at a rate of about 22% in June compared with the same month in 2013. That is down from 28% in May. One of the toughest places to save water is the high desert town of California City. As Emily Guerin from KPCC in Los Angeles reports, that story begins back in 1956.
Imagine a real estate developer named Nat Mendelson. He is driving into the desert north of Los Angeles with Elvis blaring on his car radio.
If your baby leaves you, you've got a tale to tell. Or just take a walk down the
The city in his rearview mirror is booming. The population of LA County would grow almost 50% between 1950 and 1960. Mendelson wants to cash in on that growth, so he's out looking for two things: cheap land and lots of water. He finds them both 40 miles north of Los Angeles.
This article in it was burned. It was dated January 22nd, 1959.
That's Steve Kolrick. He's the former police chief of California City. He's kind of an unusual guy.
Most police chiefs are not president of the Historical Society.
Kolrick pulls out a faded newspaper article from a giant box of documents and reads the headline.
Vast lake found under Mojave Desert.
That's right. Underneath a bountiful cotton farm, Mendelson found a huge aquifer. Using some sketchy real estate tactics, he bought the farm and immediately started planning for a huge city that he envisioned would one day rival Los Angeles.
They would take out full-page colored advertisements.
Kolrick pulls out a copy of the Los Angeles Herald Examiner from 1962. A blonde woman is dipping her toe in a man-made waterfall in front of distant mountains.
The headline is, California City, a community for tomorrow, grows on the high desert.
Mendelson started planning for tomorrow today. He didn't wait for the people to come to put in roads or even to name them. He didn't wait to build that waterfall. And he didn't wait to put in water pipelines. 170 miles of them, curving through the desert along empty lots.
They wanted an image that if you moved here, this was waiting for you.
Except there was a problem.
They built it. They just didn't come. So we're still having to maintain those infrastructures.
That's Craig Platt,
Director of Public Works for the City of California City.
The man who is now dealing with the fallout of Mendelson's big dream.
Today you couldn't develop like this. They don't allow you to develop.
That's probably a good thing, huh?
And we're probably the model of why you don't.
Here's why. California City never developed the way Nat Mendelson intended. The industries he was banking on to relocate didn't materialize. Today, there are more vacant lots than homes. The city only rivals LA in one way. It's huge, the third largest in the state by area. but less than 15,000 people live there. That means all those water lines Mendelssohn put in, they're just sitting there, rusting. And recently, they've started breaking in really dramatic ways.
We're going to the geyser that I described to you when I was driving back into town.
Mayor Jennifer Wood is weaving her SUV down one of the city's many abandoned roads, AC blasting in 100-degree heat. Last year, she saw what looked like a house burning, but when she drove closer...
Basically, it looked like a plume of smoke, but it was actually water that was in the air, quite substantive.
It was a giant water line break, one of 400 major leaks in the city last year. Other geysers have blasted holes through asphalt, sending heavy chunks flying in all directions.
I always worried about the loss of life, because knowing what you could see it tearing up a road, well, that's a very hard substance. What would it do to a child?
Wood says it's these breaks that are the reason why California City never met the state's demands that it cut water use by over a third. The city is starting to replace its aging water pipelines, but it's a slow, expensive process.
Bottom line, it's money. We could do a whole lot with $500 million, but we're not wealthy.
Still, Steve Kolrick thinks the city could do better, like watering the city-owned golf course at night instead of the heat of the day.
Any problem any of us had, it shouldn't wait till somebody else points it out to you. You solve it yourself.
City officials say they are solving it. Major waterline breaks are way down compared to last year. Craig Platt with Public Works says his department is no longer spending all its time chasing leaks.
The main goal was to actually manage the water system, not let the system manage the department.
It appears to be working. In June, the city used 19% less water than it did at the same time 2 years ago. But now that the state has rolled back mandatory water conservation, water use in California City is rising again. And this time, leaky pipes are not to blame.
For Here and Now, I'm Emily Guerin, reporting from California City, California.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.